As this is an event sponsored in part by the Thomistic Institute, we take a page from the medieval playbook. During his regencies in Paris, St. Thomas Aquinas was accustomed in both semesters to give what are called quod libido questions. So he would kind of go out in the open air and take questions from all comers, those who were inspired by a genuine desire to know and those who were inspired by a genuine desire to be difficult. And he answered them all with equanimity and with charity. And St. Thomas is actually distinguished because among his contemporaries, he is said to have done the most. So he loved the truth to such an extent that he was content to answer all questions as proffered. So all the speakers here have generously agreed to answer questions. Those main speakers are also joined by Professor Carlos Ayer of this estimable institution, where he teaches the Catholic Intellectual Tradition course and specifically Reformation history, and by Father Dominic Legg of the Order of Preachers, who is the director of the Thomistic Institute and who teaches at our own faculty in Washington, D.C., and specializes in Christology. So at this point, you can feel free to ask whatever questions have arisen over the course of the entirety of the day. We're going to privilege questions from students, you know, to be of service, especially to the student community here at Yale. So if I say, hold that thought, it's with no disrespect. It's just with the desire to hear those questions that may not otherwise come forth. So provided there aren't any questions about questions, we'll take questions. So.
This question is mainly for Father Brent. So you mentioned that free will is the unguided ability to opt for something. And Professor Kyle also alluded to the common contemporary objection that we're currently facing about neuroscientific materialism. And of course, many people are going to say that our decisions are not unguided. They are very much guided by the neurons firing in our brain, and knowledge is simply a product of our neuropsychological processes. And I'm just wondering if you can speak more about how we can respond to this common objection that we're facing.
Okay, well, that's a big question. The question is, what do you do with kind of reductive materialism? First point is just a point of clarification. When I said that freedom is an unguided ability to opt, what I meant was that's how we, in the contemporary scene, sort of interpret our experience of freedom, having sort of a world of options around us. We think of it as this ability to opt one way or the other. Whereas on St. Thomas Aquinas' understanding of freedom, it's not unguided, it's guided by the truth. We choose according to the appearance of goodness. As good. So it's guided in that way by intellect. So will is rational appetite. As far as the question of reductive materialism, we shouldn't say that, you know, if we're just chemicals in a void and acting, and the chemicals are interacting according to the laws of nature and our actions flow out of that, I wouldn't say that our actions are being guided. I'd say they're being determined. They're being determined by a lower level of causality, just physical causes altogether. And Thomas Aquinas definitely presupposes, or believes, we should say, that if that's all that is the case, right? If we simply have physical causes at work, and if we're nothing but material beings, then we're not going to exercise free choice. So in order for us to exercise free choice, there needs to be a kind of causality we have in which our actions, or especially the movements of our intellect and will, are not predetermined or determined by physical causes or external causes acting in a coercive manner, externally, violently, against us. That's something he takes as a given. So here's where we get a kind of dilemma. Either we exercise free choice, or all of our actions are determined by physical causes. But it can't be both. Okay, we'll set aside what contemporary philosophers call compatibilism as a thesis. Aquinas thinks that just doesn't make sense. So either you say we exercise free choices, and in which case you can actually use that as an argument against physical determinism, or you assert universal physical determinism, in which case you rule out free choice. So then it becomes a question of which experience or claim is going to adjudicate and which is being adjudicated. And I think for Aquinas, that we have free will is a kind of such a fundamental given that adjudicates higher level theories about causality. Whereas in the contemporary context, they use much higher level theories of causality to try to adjudicate our experience of free will or the claim of free will and say, well, free will just doesn't exist. So which is going to be adjudicating and which is going to be adjudicated? Are we going to use our fundamental experience, our self-experience, and our experience of choosing, because that's given in our experience? Are we going to use that to adjudicate large-scale theories of causality? Or are we going to use large-scale theories of causality, which are much less evident to us at first, to adjudicate whether we have free will or not, or whether that experience is authentic or illusory? That's where I would go.
Let me add a couple of thoughts to that. There are different ways to engage this argument. The one that I prefer is to sort of allow it, the proposition, the reductionist proposition, to allow it to sort of be taken initially in good faith and run with it as far as one can, which is, after all, to act in the intent of reductionism. What you then ask yourself, first of all, if reductionism was true, it couldn't be an argument. Because there would be no one to be persuaded by it. As an argument, it sort of suffers immediately from this performative contradiction that what it claims is in fact a claim to which there is no longer any domain from which it could be falsified. It falls down as an argument simply because it doesn't recognize any terms that are extrinsic to it. And so it fails in that sense the basic logical requirement of what an argument actually is. Taking a second argument to make would be that it fails to distinguish between what are necessary conditions for consciousness, and nobody would have denied at any point in history that consciousness has also a material dimension to it, in the sense that, for instance, we see that people who are inebriated or habitually use drugs or something, their conscious sense or conscious awareness of the world is distorted in all kinds of ways. And so that, however, nobody would have, until fairly recently at least, would not have inferred from that because consciousness can be shown to have as its substratum certain material foundation, that therefore it itself is merely a chimera or an epiphenomenon. This is what I meant when I said the sort of tendency in reductionism to make the explanandum, that which stands to be explained, simply disappear in the explanation. Well, then nothing has been tendered by way of an explanation. To explain something is, in a way, to accept from the outset the integrity of the phenomenon that asks for an explanation. And that's where reductionism fails. So, and then there is the question of, again, taking it all the way. Where would that actually leave us? Aristotle has a wonderful discussion in the Nicomachean Ethics, I don't quite recall where, about being drunk. And about it is of course true that in a certain sense one may do things that are palpably irresponsible in virtue of having, at the time of doing them, been drunk. But the decision to get drunk still was there. It was, so again, you can see that even in that case, one needs to make distinctions between that can never result in choice and responsible choice to be completely voided as a possibility by such, say, a miscarriage of consciousness as he describes. So I would just say one can, of course, oppose the arguments by simply so stipulating that consciousness and responsible choice and the notion of the will as a rational appetite are really more effective notions. I totally subscribe to that view. But in a way, one would then draw on a vocabulary, and here we may or may not agree, but one will find oneself on a vocabulary and on a language of reasoning that the reductionists typically don't speak. That's why I think it is, in a way, reductionism is best sort of defeated by initially allowing its terms to sort of to shape the conversation, but then see what falls by the wayside. And what is interesting, what falls by the wayside, are all these other concepts. Responsibility, love, compassion. Because consciousness is not somehow an abstraction, but it exists in countless qualia, in countless qualities and manifestations, which is what I sort of alluded to at the beginning of my talk. You know, that to be conscious is also to be conscious of a certain quality of being. It's not some kind of value-neutral notion. And I don't think that there would be a lot of I can think maybe of one or two hard-boiled sort of reductionists. One of them is a colleague at Duke, alas, who might actually be willing to surrender all that too, but not very many. I think at that point they begin to look and shift a little uneasily in their seats. If you explain to them what you will actually lose in terms of a textured vocabulary to describe what we call the human. Pretty much everything.
If you deny the existence of free will, you have a lot of bullets to fight.
Yes, yes. More than you have teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Add something to this, and this is actually connected with what Dr. Byers was talking about. It's also to do, I think, with what we mean by rational or intellect, as opposed to just cognition. At least that's a distinction that Aquinas would draw. So he would admit that animals have cognition in some way. That means they have some kind of grasp through their nervous system of what's around them. I mean, they receive sense impressions, they have memories, they may have an imagination, but what they don't have is intellection or understanding, which for the Thomistic view, and I think also very much many others, involves a higher level of neural activity, and in fact transcends anything material, so that it can't simply be reduced to the matter, but involves a kind of spiritual abstraction from matter. So being able to understand the universal, which matter simply can't do. And this is related to the issue of freedom, because it's precisely the rational creature that now, by understanding in an abstract way the good, is able to make judgments about how to move towards the good or how to realize the good. It's a qualitatively different kind of activity than an animal is making in moving towards appetible goods that it perceives through its senses. And that's because of the abstraction, or the kind of higher light that the human intellect has. And likewise, I think this touches on questions about artificial intelligence, where often the assumption is that intelligence just can be kind of reduced to calculation or functional operations, rather than understanding that in fact human intelligence is operating in a way different from computer computer analysis.
Yeah, and we should all be very glad to know that at Caltech and Oxford, for several years, they were running experiments to prove or disprove the assertion that we all live in a hologram, that the universe is a hologram. And the result was, at least for now, no. This is real. But I think one sort of red thread through the link between Christianity and freedom, and especially questions about freedom of the will and the freedom to choose, which material reductionism, of course, does away with, but that's what I think is distinctively Christian about seeing the transcendence, is that employing one's freedom, choosing, affects not only one's life in this dimension, but for eternity. Yeah. And the way in which Christian ethics have always been linked to the question of whether or not our choices will lead us to the good place or the bad place. And so that's something one finds from the New Testament on, like a nice bright red thread running through. And in the period I study, 16th and 17th century especially, this is the burning question, is, you know, how much freedom do we have to actually determine where we end up for eternity? I got a lot of hate mail from reductionist materialists in my book, A Very Brief History of Eternity. And all the hate mail basically said that eternity was a very stupid idea. Just totally stupid. As one letter stated, human beings constantly consume. All we do is consume. So if human beings would live forever, eventually we would consume the entire universe. Another said we would forever, eternally, be bored. And so on and so forth. There's no notion of transcendence, right? Transcendence attached to our choices, to the use of our will. And that's what struck me in all the presentations. It was sometimes above the surface, or like a geological formation that goes up above. Sometimes it was implicit rather than explicit. But freedom has consequences, I guess is another way.
And if I may add a little codicil to the conversation ongoing, clearly going on the issues of the will, free will, and so on. It's crucial that we think about what are the traits of the will, since free will really deals with, it's not just a question of freedom, but it's a question of willing. And the trait of willing, what belongs to the faculty of the will, is always mobility, emotion. You can have a free intellect, I'm sure. You know, we would say that my mind is very, very clean and very pure. But the fact is that it's the will. The will can never be in a state of inertia. We must exercise free will unless we really want to lapse into inertia. The will is what leads us to an action, makes us go left or go right in and of itself. It's a trait, it's a quality that belongs to that faculty. And that is what sort of makes unavoidable that we talk about free will. Because if you really can go one way or the other, then it's up to us to make decisions about which way to turn. I think it's a little bit of a notation about the question of what willing really implies. And my two cents contribution.
I was just going to say, as a follow-up to Father Dominic's point, the actual art of Sylvia,
yes.
I didn't actually hear your question, but hopefully this is still on point. That the actual argument for the immateriality of the mind from intellection that he was referring to is a universal concept covers an infinite number of particulars. So if you know the kind of thing that a tree is, you can recognize any tree, and it covers the entire set, the whole domain of all possible trees. And then the argument is that particular things are not infinite, and material things are particular. So the concept cannot be a material thing. So the concept must be something immaterial that's inside of us, and therefore we must have an immaterial dimension. And free choice is a feature of rationality, because when we're deciding to do something, we're making a judgment that a proposition that is opposed to concepts is true or false. So we're saying to ourselves, this is the most appropriate thing for me to do, or this is not the most appropriate thing for me to do in these circumstances, and that's what a decision is. So in order to be able to affirm something with your mind, affirm a proposition or negate a proposition, you have to have concepts. So the argument is like that. If we have concepts, we are immaterial, and if we have concepts, or if we have free choice, we have concepts, and if we have free choice, we're immaterial. So the Stoics actually don't see that. The Stoics think that we're material, and they think that reason is rarefied fire that's in us, and that it's identical with God. So we can say they're wrong about that, but they don't seem to have paid much attention to this argument from Aristotle, which is the classic argument that I think Father Donnelly was referring to. But for those who are interested in studying the history of the question of whether the mind is immaterial, one book that can be helpful as a starting point is called The Reality of the Mind, and the subtitle is St. Augustine's Arguments for the Mind as a Spiritual Substance, and it's by Fulcher. Anyway, I can tell you the name afterwards if you want to ask about the name of the author, but that's a good starting point, and then from there you can read Aquinas and Constantinus or something. Or Nagel, of course, for those of you who are not philosophy majors, you may not have read Thomas Nagel's article, What's It Like to Be a Bat?, which is about consciousness. This is a starting point for many people today in thinking about consciousness. It's an old article at this point, it's 30 years old or something, but something a lot of people read in Philosophy 101, so if you're interested in that question, something to know about.
As you talked about freedom and sort of various perspectives on it, I enjoyed hearing the interplay between freedom as nature, freedom as thought, freedom as transcendence, articulating of that, and clearly many perspectives on the same thing. One of the things that it keeps coming back to, and this is particularly true when I look at it in the Thomistic context, is this ability to recognize an underlying transcendent reality in some fashion. One of the great controversies of the Reformation, which has continued to this day, and it certainly did start then, was over how reliable our reasoning actually is. And Aquinas seems to me to have followed the Greeks in thinking that reason was reliable in a way that the senses and passions were not. This may be particularly for Father Brett, but anyone else, sort of how reliable do we have to believe our reason is for this picture of freedom to work?
That's a great question. It's a huge question that the whole panel should speak to, but I can start off with a basic point. Aquinas thinks that the fall did not intrinsically damage our intellect, so we can still get the quiddities of things from the world around us, and we can still understand them to an extent enough to rise up to the first principle of all contingent being and that sort of thing, and have also some at least rudimentary knowledge of good and of what's good and what's evil, so that we can choose it. But Aquinas also acknowledges that because of the fall, the rest of the human being is ravaged pretty badly. And so even though reason as a power or a faculty in itself is not intrinsically damaged, reasoners, human beings, are. And so we have all sorts of difficulties in acquiring wisdom in a higher degree, or certainly to a perfect degree. And I think that's just one sort of starting point I'll make, and then I'd like the rest of the panel to kind of jump in. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Okay. So how reliable can we think our reason to be? I would say that the question needs to be slightly amended, if you'll accept that, to the point that we remind ourselves that as human beings we are sort of situated in what Augustine calls sort of the diastasis, the distended time, so that our sense of the reliability or unreliability of our rational faculties is never a matter that is somehow to be adjudicated at a certain point in time. Because we also have a memory of having reasoned in a certain way, having perhaps, as the case may be, failed to reason well on that occasion. So that reason is, I think it's very important at all times to remind ourselves of the sort of what Alistair MacIntyre would insist is the narrative structure in which we are intelligible agents. That agency is not, as in contemporary thought is so often suggested, a kind of matter of decisionism, here, now, instantaneously, and immediately. But rather that our decisions are informed by our memories, they are informed by habits that we have evolved over time, hopefully good habits. They are also our conscious awareness of the decision we are facing is invariably filtered against the background conditions of what we remember by way of analogous situations. So that there is, I mean, this is what, say, Michael Polanyi in his work on personal knowledge or knowing and being calls a tacit dimension. Knowledge is never simply, and reasoning is never merely a matter of sort of something becoming sort of 100% explicit now and then fading altogether. But it is always informed by a deep narrative and sort of temporal background story. If we were reasoners in the eternal present only, I wouldn't place much stock in our capacity to be reasoners. I think habits and virtues and patterns of memory are absolutely an ingredient, a central and indispensable ingredient of what it means to be a rational being. And I think that is where a lot of sort of contemporary thought since Descartes, which tends to disaggregate everything, fails in a way to describe what it means to be a practical reasoner in the first place. We don't confront situations as though they came as were ex nihilo. They're always in a way defined by as more or less familiar because we filter them against memories and also against a sense of the priorities of the goods to which we feel ourselves obligated. So that's why I would say reason in that sense is very much something that also has a sort of temporal and also therefore a sort of self-correcting dimension to it. Moreover, we don't just reason, again, the Cartesian model is so misleading. We don't just reason as though it was some kind of, you know, pressure cooker that was sort of with the lid firmly closed. We reason with one another. So, I mean, logos is also dialogos. So we, you know, we also, in a way, try to sort of make our reasons for should I do X or Y in a given choice. Before we proceed, ideally, we try to reason with ourselves, but also sometimes make ourselves intelligible to others. Yeah. So, in that sense, reason to me is an extraordinarily complex hermeneutic constellation in which a myriad of micro judgments are made at all times. So, there is something always sort of improvisatory or aleatory about it, in the sense that, you know, if I hadn't, I'm facing a difficult situation, it needs to be resolved by tomorrow morning, and I wander out of the supermarket and for some reason, you might call it grace, the colleague who I know will give me the best advice and will have the best ear for listening to my reasoning happens to stand there. And so I begin to sort of talk about it. So there's also an element of, you know, Aristotle might call it moral luck. But reason is certainly not this sort of punctum that somehow we often take it to be in contemporary descriptions. That, I think, leads to a kind of desperately impoverished and misleading.
Yeah, the excuse me if I just add a little thing here. There is indeed a kind of excitement about the Enlightenment, and I feel this being sort of going through in the questions and answers, that as if the Enlightenment is really the time that reason becomes the goddess, and it manages to provide bring light to things that have been kept in the dark, not quite explored, even trying to do away or rethink a faith, issues such as faith. But here we talk about reasonable to see, look at it within, I think, a very large context. I believe that a good part of the 20th century, the better part of the 20th century, has really tried to do away with this kind of mythical view of reason and the possibilities of reason. Reason manages to clarify everything. It is self-correcting, you're absolutely right, that it makes a mistake, and in time they manage to correct themselves. But the whole issue is that they made mistakes that can never really be have never been corrected. Already in the 18th century and even before, the mistakes that therefore reason has to be seen in the light of other intuitions, other insights, other perspectives. And the only thing that I would add to this conversation on this point is that we really need to have several perspectives in dealing with and not reduce whatever a problem may be to one single component. Indeed, a dialogue is a conversation among us, but it's really the idea that we have to be willing to look at issues from different viewpoints. Maybe the language of the encyclopedia, of encyclopedic, the circle of knowledge, is really the thing that we ought to strive for, because it sort of it does provide a kind of familiarity with rationality, with reason, and yet there are many other things to be seen, you know, through the lenses of the arts, through the and other ways of knowing. Knowledge is a very complex phenomenon. That's all.
Can I just throw out to just very briefly, I was trying to find, I have, of course, as any Dominican should who has a smartphone, the collected works of Aquinas on his smartphone, trying to find the passage of Aquinas in the Summa where he talks about how the intellect is affected by original Summa. I couldn't find it. But so let me, I won't say anything about that, but I will say, you know, there's in the wake of the Reformation, certain strands of Protestant theology that really very strongly reject philosophy in any in theology at all. So, like, you meet Bardians who will very strong, you know, they regard philosophy as a kind of principle of the Antichrist. You know, it has to be expunged so that the purity of revelation can shine forth. And at the Thomistic Institute, actually going back about 8 years, we've had a running dialogue with the Bardians at Princeton Theological Seminary. So, like, these are the smartest and best Bardian, you know, American Bardian scholars coming to us, and we going to them and having these very high-level debates. And what it seemed quite clear, I think, at least to the Thomists in that dialogue after a while, is that they are doing philosophy without acknowledging that they're doing it. They have a kind of principle that says we can't do philosophy, so we're not doing philosophy, and then they proceed to do philosophy without telling you that they're doing it. So they have to camouflage it because of this presupposition that reason is so corrupted. But in fact, what you see is that even to try and understand God revealing himself to us, you have to use your mind somehow, and you're going to have some things. So if we have contact with reality in a way that allows us to understand, there must be something still there of our intellectual capacity or the light of reason, aided by the light of grace, but not, it's not just like a totally alien light or something like that. It's perfecting nature. I think that is a kind of standard Thomistic understanding, is that grace is perfecting nature, so it's acting on nature. It's not just replacing it or supplanting it entirely. Yeah, so maybe that's sufficient. I mean, the only other thing that I would add is that there's a lot more to be said about the way our passions are affected by sin. So, when that gets out of control in us, and we start with a kind of already a disorder that we inherit, And then the more we actually sin, so we start with that from an original sin, but the more we actually sin, the more disordered it gets. And so the harder time we have with understanding what's really going on around us. So that you end up with the kind of person that Father Brent was describing, the heroin addict, who just now thinks that heroin is good, even though everyone around him is saying, you're destroying your life.
I just want to clarify one thing about natural law theory in relation to your question. Someone asked me this after my talk, and I should have made it more clear. So I was explaining what the seeds of the virtues are, and I said they're claiming that we automatically recognize good actions as good and bad actions as bad. But I don't want to give the impression that the idea is that our reason infallibly recognizes in every case. And the way that they make this distinction, the Stoics, and I think basically it's followed in Aquinas in his own terminology, is that we automatically sort of know or get the concept of what kinds of things are appropriate. So in Aquinas' language, it's actions that are wrong by their object, we recognize as such. So stealing is wrong. So these are the things also in the Ten Commandments, if you think about the Ten Commandments. Adultery is wrong, stealing is wrong. But to recognize in each particular circumstance or case how to apply those, that is something that you need habituation for, you need prudence for. So that's not from nature directly. But then, because of the fall, the ability even to recognize what actions are wrong by their object can be corrupted. And this is where Aquinas talks about the Germans thinking that stealing isn't wrong, even though that's actually something we know, quote unquote, by natural law, naturally in a corrupted state of natural reason, by bad customs or whatever that come about ultimately because we're fallen, we can be wrong even at that level.
Okay, we think we have time for one or two more questions. So, please.
So since the title of the conference is Christianism, I'm reminded of I'm reminded of a quote from Professor Faust, Mind in the Modern, in which he says, it has often been argued that pre-Christian thought did not have a concept of the will. And in the same paragraph, Professor Faust also argued that in sort of early modern philosophy of Hobbes and Locke, we find the strange idea that the will is regarded as, I quote, an inscrutable and non-cognitive causality. I wonder if each of the panel speakers, if you think that there is, historically speaking, some kind of rough correlation between Christianity, or Catholicism in particular, and freedom of the will, such that, you know, when we see the Catholic hegemony on the intelligentsia falling in the Reformation, you have different attempts to deny the freedom of the will from Protestant theologians, and then with the scientific worldview, there's increasing difficulty in justifying any view that involves freedom. If you do think that there's such a correlation, do you think there's... What is it about the Christian tradition that especially attracts thinkers to think about freedom, to justify freedom? Or is there any special resource in our tradition that help us to understand and defend the idea?
If I may go back to my previous statement, too, I think it's the fact that in the Christian tradition, since the first century, choosing is connected to eternity, to the afterlife.
Hmm.
And this is why the question keeps returning over and over in different voices, in different manners. The question keeps coming up, how much responsibility do we have for our actions? In the Reformation era, there isn't a single branch of the Christian tree, Catholic or Protestant, that doesn't have fierce debates and schisms of all kinds over the question of how much responsibility the individual has for choosing their eternal future. And the debates go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But the end result for the Catholic tradition in the Council of Trent, I think, speaks for the Catholic tradition, which is free will is affirmed, but so is predestination. But Council of Trent has a warning. Yes, there is predestination, but don't ever dare make a judgment as to whether you are, you yourself, or anyone, is predestined. That's entirely up to God. So they affirm the paradox fully, and that doesn't stop the discussion in the 17th century. It just keeps coming back. 18th century and 21st century keeps coming back. But one of the most frightening passages in Calvin's Institutes, and he's not talking about predestination when he brings up this example, but he wants to point out that human beings have basically no agency, but they're still responsible. But this frightening passage is that Calvin says there is no such thing as an accident. If somebody's walking under a tree, a branch breaks, hits this person on the head, and kills them, God foreordained that from before the creation of the universe. And Calvin applies that to the choices human beings make. That's that extreme. I think in many ways the Council of Trent is of course saying that that's a little too much. But we do have agency, but we also have God who foreknows and foreordains simultaneously. And the two things don't cancel each other out.
Perhaps we can proceed to the next question.
No, I have several questions. I started with one, and now I have several. But it's related to your question in a sense, and to the response in a sense, because my question is, which is what I want to use now, is to what extent is free will constrained by personal experience and by the situation in which somebody is? Because if a person does not know that he or she has a particular choice, that option, then how can they make the decision to have that option? So individual people may have different options in terms of what choices they can make with respect to free will. And how does that also relate to responsibility? Individual responsibility, which leads us back to think of judge not, lest you be judged. And I'm going to stop there because I was going to add something to the response about predestination. And I'll leave the question right there.
I think that the Beato Aquinas and the tradition he's coming out of, the ancient and earlier medieval tradition, is that ignorance removes or lessens the voluntary nature of an action. So if someone who has options that they don't know about because someone hides them from them or fails to tell them about them, or the person is somehow prevented from learning about them through earlier experiences that they had, they weren't educated properly by their parents or whatever, then the choices that they make have lessened culpability. So I don't know if that partly addresses what you're asking about. Just because we choose something doesn't mean we have the same degree of culpability that another person has for choosing the same thing, because our experiences are not entirely controlled by ourselves. You know, all of the influences that we're currently under did not come about as a result of our own prior choices that we made in full knowledge. So to the extent that we're conditioned by other people and circumstances outside of our control, we have less responsibility for doing things that another person might have in the same situation.
Maybe Professor Fowd, if you'd like to follow on in that regard, and then we could wrap things up.
Conceptually, I just thought it's interesting what you describe. In a way, I think is sort of realistically the situation in which just about all choices that we make are made. It is highly unlikely that a human being in any given context could ever be demonstratively be said to have made a choice with an exhaustive awareness of all possible courses of action. So here again, we are dealing with a spectrum. such that, for instance, the choices, there may be many choices that you know, suggest themselves to me in a given situation that calls for some form of moral judgment. But as Iris Murdoch in a wonderful book, you know, The Sovereignty of Good, points out, in many ways, the choices that will really sort of become the focus of my decision-making have already been set by a legacy of habits and experiences. Leaving aside informational deficits of the kind that you described, it is simply the fact that I'm a particular person with particular habits, memories, expectations, and notions of what to aim at overall, what good to support by the local choices I make. And so in that sense, in a way, the whole point is, of course, to make an informed choice, but also a choice to which I'm, in a certain sense, committed. Actually choosing a particular course of action is, however, and this is the other part that I wanted to stress, in an essay from the 30s, Heidegger points out that, you know, the word choice in the Greek, krinein, always implies something unfathomable. That is, the very fact that I have to choose at all means that the outcome at which my choosing A rather than B aims is not guaranteed. If it was guaranteed, I wouldn't be experiencing the moment as choice. It would just be doing naturally what I do. So choosing, in a way, has to be understood as a situation in which I grasp the situation that calls for some kind of judgment as also being inherently, in some ways, oblique. I cannot prejudge whether the choice I make is absolutely the right one. If I could, I wouldn't experience it as a choice. And that's why I think it's very important to distinguish logically between action and behavior. Now, behavior, in a certain sense, is the kind of sort of run-of-the-mill doing in the world that we experience. No, I put sugar in my cup. Naturally, I'm going to start stirring it now. So that is not right. I imagine what it would be like if we had to really make choices on everything. Terrible. So in that sense, I think it's the condition of choosing is always sort of hemmed or circumscribed by a sort of partially opaque horizon. And that is, I think, that is again what I would say it means to be human in time, in a temporal framework. So,
Dr. Powell has just illustrated why being Dominican makes you free, because you just wear the same thing every day. But I was going to say, you know, to take your question maybe to another level, there's one sort of deprivation, which would be deprivation of material possibilities. You know, I don't have a good job, and so, or I don't have enough money to buy the things that I want, or the airport is closed because of the storm that came through, and now I'm stuck here, and so I'm in a certain way constrained by those things. But on a higher level, the freedom, the higher form of freedom, is a spiritual freedom, which isn't capable of being constrained by material lack or material shortages. And that's the higher nobility that we can attain to, so that even someone who's physically chained in a prison can remain free. And, Solzhenitsyn speaks about this in a beautiful way. But you also might think about then what this tells us about even the Catholic tradition about the corporal works of mercy and the spiritual works of mercy. The spiritual works of mercy are actually of a higher order, because they are ministering in a way to the spiritual freedom of the soul to impart the truth. So in a certain way, it's more important to know the truth. I mean, okay, you have to have what you need to sustain the body and being, of course. So if you don't have food and shelter and clothing, teaching somebody the truth isn't getting them much. But on another level, assuming you have a kind of sufficient material existence, teaching the truth is actually more important than adding to the material abundance in a certain respect, because it can open, especially when you're talking about the kind of supernatural freedom that one can have, it's worth more than all of those other kind of material options. Not to say that we shouldn't provide those, but just that they're of a lower order, and so relative goods.
I ask that you join me in thanking our speakers.